Oh, why not take this one on? Politics and political orientations. So humans keep getting weirder. Multiple hierarchies and having leaders and occasionally choosing them and doing so with some silly implicit criteria. Now let's plunge into politics. Franz de Waal introduced the term politics into primatology with his classic book Chimpanzee Politics, using it in the sense of Machiavellian intelligence, non-human primates struggling in socially complex manners to control access to resources. The book documents chimpanzee genius for such maneuvering. This is politics in the traditional human sense as well. But I will use a more restricted, starry-eyed sense, which is politics being the struggle among the powerful with differing visions of the common good. Forget liberals accusing conservatives of waging war on the poor. Ditto conservatives accusing those depraved liberals of destroying family values. Cutting through this posturing will assume that everyone equally desires that people do as well as possible, but differs as to how best to accomplish this. In this section, we'll focus on three issues. A. Do political orientations tend to be internally consistent? E.g., do people's opinions about their town's littering policy and about military actions in Somewhere-istan come as an ideological package? Quick answer, usually. B. Do such consistent orientations arise from deep, implicit factors with remarkably little to do with specific political issues? Yep. C. Can one begin to detect the bits of biology underlying these factors? Of course. The internal consistency of political orientation. The previous chapter examined the remarkable consistency in us-them orientations. People who dislike a particular outgroup on economic grounds are likelier than chance to dislike another group on historical grounds, another on cultural, and so on. Much the same is true here. Social, economic, environmental, and international political orientations tend to come in a package. This consistency explains the humor behind a New Yorker cartoon, pointed out by the political psychologist John Jost, showing a woman modeling a dress for her husband and asking, "Does this dress make me look Republican?" Another example concerns the bioethicist Leon Cass, who not only has had influential conservative stances on human cloning, finding the possibility repugnant, but also finds it repugnant when people display the cat-like activity of licking ice cream cones in public. More to come on his issues, including with licking ice cream cones. What this internal consistency suggests is that political ideology is merely one manifestation of broader, underlying ideology. As we'll see, this helps explain conservatives being more likely than liberals to have cleaning supplies in their bedrooms. Naturally, strict consistency in political ideology isn't always the rule. Libertarians are a mixture of social liberalism and economic conservatism. Conversely, Black Baptist churches are traditionally economically liberal but socially conservative, for example, rejecting both gay rights and the idea that gay rights are a form of civil rights. Moreover, neither extreme of political ideology is monolithic. And ignoring that, I'll be simplifying throughout by using liberal and left-wing interchangeably, as well as conservative and right-wing. Nonetheless, the building blocks of political orientation tend to be stable and internally consistent. It's usually possible to dress like a Republican or lick ice cream like a Democrat. Implicit factors underlying political orientation. If political ideology is but one manifestation of larger internal forces pertinent to everything from cleaning supplies in the bedroom to ice cream consumption, are there psychological, affective, cognitive, and visceral ways in which leftists and rightists tend to differ? This question has produced deeply fascinating findings. I'll try to corral them into some categories. Intelligence. Oh, what the hell? Let's begin with something inflammatory. Starting with Theodore Adorno in the 1950s, people have suggested that lower intelligence predicts adherence to conservative ideology. Some, but not all, studies since then have supported this conclusion. More consistent has been a link between lower intelligence and a subtype of conservatism, namely right-wing authoritarianism, RWA, a fondness for hierarchy. One particularly thorough demonstration of this involved more than 15,000 subjects in the UK and United States. Importantly, the links among low IQ, RWA, and intergroup prejudice were there after controlling for education and socioeconomic status. The standard, convincing explanation for the link is that RWA provides simple answers, ideal for people with poor abstract reasoning skills. Intellectual style. This literature has two broad themes. One is that rightists are relatively uncomfortable intellectually with ambiguity. This is covered below. The other is that leftists, well, think harder, have a greater capacity for what the political scientist Philip Tetlock of the University of Pennsylvania calls integrative complexity. In one study, conservatives and liberals, when asked about the causes of poverty, both tended toward personal attributions. They're poor because they're lazy. But only if they had to make snap judgments. Give people more time, and liberals shifted toward situational explanations. Wait, things are stacked against the poor. In other words, conservatives start gut and stay gut. Liberals go from gut to head. This differing attributional style extends way beyond politics. Tell liberals or conservatives about a guy who trips over someone's feet while learning a dance, ask for a snap assessment, and everyone does personal attribution. The guy's clumsy. It's only with time that the liberals go situational. Maybe the dance is really difficult. Obviously, this dichotomy isn't perfect. Rightists did personal attribution for Lewinsky Gate, Bill Clinton's rotten, while leftists did situational. It's a vast right-wing conspiracy. And things ran the opposite with Nixon and Watergate. However, they are pretty reliable. Why the difference? Liberals and conservatives are equally capable of thinking past gut personal attributions to subtler situational ones. When asked to do so, both are equally adept at dispassionately presenting the viewpoints of the opposite camp. It's that liberals are more motivated to push towards situational explanations. Why? Some have suggested it's a greater respect for thinking, which readily becomes an unhelpful tautology. Linda Skitka of the University of Illinois emphasizes how the personal attributions of snap judgments readily feel dissonant to liberals, at odds with their principles. Thus, they are motivated to think their way to a more consonant view. In contrast, even with more time, conservatives don't become more situational, because there's no dissonance. While logical, this just turfs us to asking where the liberal ideology causing the dissonance comes from in the first place. As we'll see, it comes from factors having little to do with cognitive style. These findings suggest that it's easier to make a liberal think like a conservative than the other way around. Or, stated in a familiar way, increasing cognitive load should make people more conservative. This is precisely the case. The time pressure of snap judgments is a version of increased cognitive load. Likewise, people become more conservative when tired, in pain, or distracted with a cognitive task, or when blood alcohol levels rise. Recall from Chapter 3 that willpower takes metabolic power, thanks to the glucose demands of the frontal cortex. This was the finding that when people are hungry, they become less generous in economic games. A real-world example of this is startling. In a study of more than 1,100 judicial rulings, prisoners were granted parole at about a 60% rate when judges had recently eaten, and at essentially a 0% rate just before judges ate. Note also the overall decline over the course of a tiring day. Justice may be blind, but she's sure sensitive to her stomach gurgling. Moral cognition. Another minefield. Surprise, people at both ends of the political spectrum accuse the other side of impoverished moral thought. One direction of this is seemingly bolstered by Chapter 7's Kohlberg Stages of Moral Development. Liberals, steeped in civil disobedience, tend to be at a higher Kohlberg stage than our conservatives, with their fondness for law and order. Are rightists less intellectually capable of reasoning at a more advanced Kohlberg stage, or are they less motivated to do so? Seemingly the latter. Rightists and leftists are equally capable of presenting the other's perspective. Jonathan Haidt of NYU provides a very different view. He identifies six foundations of morality: care versus harm, fairness versus cheating, liberty versus oppression, loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion, sanctity versus degradation. Both experimental and real-world data show that liberals preferentially value the first three goals, namely care, fairness, and liberty, and, showing an overlap with Kohlbergian formulations, undervaluing loyalty, authority, and sanctity is in many ways synonymous with post-conventional thinking. In contrast, conservatives heavily value loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Obviously, this is a big difference. Is it okay to criticize your group to outsiders? Rightists? No, that's disloyal. Leftists? Yes, if justified. Should you ever disobey a law? Rightists? No, that undermines authority. Leftists? Of course, if it's a bad law. Is it okay to burn the flag? Rightists? Never, it's sacred. Leftists? Come on, it's a piece of cloth. These differing emphases explain a lot. For example, the classical liberal view is that everyone has equal rights to happiness. Rightists instead discount fairness in favor of expedient authority, generating the classical conservative view that some socioeconomic inequality is a tolerable price for things running smoothly. What does it mean that, in Haidt's view, conservatives count up six moral foundations on their toes and liberals only three? Here is where internecine sniping starts. Conservatives embrace Haidt's characterization of liberals as being morally impoverished, with half their moral foundations atrophied. The opposite interpretation, espoused by Jost and Joshua Green of Harvard, is that liberals have more refined moral foundations, having jettisoned the less important, more historically damaging ones that conservatives perseverate on. In effect, liberals count from one to three, while conservatives really only count four to six. Why are conservatives more concerned with binding foundations like loyalty, authority, and sanctity, often stepping stones to right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation? This segues to the next section. Affective psychological differences. Research consistently shows that leftists and rightists differ in overlapping categories of emotional makeup. To summarize, on the average, rightists are made more anxious by ambiguity and have a stronger need for closure, dislike novelty, are more comforted by structure and hierarchy, more readily perceive circumstances as threatening, and are more parochial in their empathy. The conservative dislike of ambiguity has been demonstrated in numerous apolitical contexts, e.g., responses to visual illusions, taste in entertainment, and is closely related to the differing feelings about novelty, which by definition evokes ambiguity and uncertainty. The differing views of novelty certainly explain the liberal view that with correct reforms, our best days are ahead of us in a novel future, whereas conservatives view our best days as behind us, in familiar circumstances that should be returned to make things great again. Once again, these differences in psychological makeup play out in apolitical realms as well. Liberals are more likely to own travel books than are conservatives. The conservative need for predictability and structure obviously fuels the emphasis on loyalty, obedience, and law and order. It also gives insights into a puzzling feature of the political landscape. How is it that over the last 50 years, Republicans have persuaded impoverished white Americans to so often vote against their own economic self-interest? Do they actually believe that they're going to win the lottery and then get to enjoy the privileged side of American inequality? Nah. The psychological issues of needing structured familiarity show that for poor whites, voting Republican constitutes an implicit act of system justification and risk aversion. Better to resist change and deal with the devil that you know. Harking back to the last chapter, gay conservatives show more implicit anti-gay biases than do gay liberals. Better to hate who you are if that bolsters a system whose stability and predictability are sources of comfort. Intertwined with these variables is the left-right difference in tendency to see things as threatening, particularly when conservatism is anchored in authoritarianism. Life is filled with ambiguity, most of all with the novel future. And if those make you anxious, lots of things will seem threatening. Now, a threat can be abstract, such as to your self-esteem. There are few political differences in the perception of such threats. The differences concern concrete threats to your keister. This helps explain political stances. "I have a list here of 200 communist spies working in the State Department" is a pretty good demonstration of imagined threat. The difference in threat perception can be apolitical. In one study, subjects had to rapidly do a task when a word flashed up on a screen. Authoritarian conservatives, but not liberals, responded more rapidly to threatening words like cancer, snake, or mugger, than to non-threatening words, e.g. telescope, tree, canteen. Moreover, as compared with liberals, such conservatives are more likely to associate arms with weapons rather than with legs, more likely to interpret ambiguous faces as threatening, and more easily conditioned to associate negative, but not positive, stimuli with neutral stimuli. Republicans report three times as many nightmares as do Democrats, particularly ones involving loss of personal power. As the saying goes, a conservative is a liberal who has been mugged. Related to this is terror management theory, which suggests that conservatism is psychologically rooted in a pronounced fear of death. Supporting this is the finding that priming people to think about their mortality makes them more conservative. These differences in threat perception help explain the differing views as to role of government, providing for people, the leftist view, social services, education, etc., or protecting people, the rightist view, law and order, the military, etc. Fear, anxiety, the terror of mortality, it must be a drag being right-wing. But despite that, in a multinational study, rightists were happier than leftists. Why? Perhaps it's having simpler answers, unburdened by motivated correction. Or, as favored by the authors, because system justification allows conservatives to rationalize and be less discomfited by inequality. And as economic inequality rises, the happiness gap between the right and the left increases. As emphasized, political ideology is just one manifestation of intellectual and emotional style. As a great example, a four-year-old's openness to a new toy predicts how open she'll be as an adult to, say, the United States forging new relations with Iran or Cuba. And of course, some underlying biology. We've now seen that political orientation is usually stable and internally consistent across a range of disparate issues, and that it is typically merely one manifestation of a package of cognitive and affective style. Stepping deeper, what are the biological correlates of differing political orientations? Back to the insular cortex and its role in mediating gustatory and olfactory disgust in mammals and in mediating moral disgust in humans. Recall from the last chapter how you can reliably stoke hatred of thems by making them seem viscerally disgusting. When people's insulae activate at the thought of thems, you can check one thing off your genocide to-do list. This recalls a remarkable finding. Stick subjects in a room with a smelly garbage can, and they become more socially conservative. If your insula is gagging from the smell of dead fish, you're more likely to decide that a social practice of an other that is merely different is, instead, just plain wrong. This leads to a thoroughly fascinating finding. Social conservatives tend toward lower thresholds for disgust than liberals. In one study, subjects were exposed to either positively or negatively charged emotional images, and galvanic skin resistance, GSR, an indirect measure of sympathetic nervous system arousal, was measured. The biggest autonomic responses to negative, but not positive, emotional images were in conservatives opposed to gay marriage or premarital sex, while GSR response was unrelated to non-social issues like free trade or gun control. Concerns about hygiene and purity sure predict valuing of sanctity. Related to that, when confronted with something viscerally disturbing, conservatives are less likely to use reappraisal strategies, e.g., when seeing something gory, thinking, this isn't real, it's staged. Moreover, when conservatives, but not liberals, are instructed to use reappraisal techniques, e.g., try to view the images in a detached, unemotional way, they express less conservative political sentiments. In contrast, a suppression strategy, don't let your feelings show when you're looking at this image, doesn't work. As we saw, make a liberal tired, hungry, rushed, distracted, or disgusted, and they become more conservative. Make a conservative more detached about something viscerally disturbing, and they become more liberal. Thus, political orientation about social issues reflects sensitivity to visceral disgust and strategies for coping with such disgust. In addition, conservatives are more likely to think that disgust is a good metric for deciding whether something is moral, which recalls Leon Cass, the bioethicist with the ice cream licking issues. He headed George W. Bush's bioethics panel, one that, thanks to Cass's anti-abortion ideology, greatly restricted embryonic stem cell research. Cass has argued for what he calls the wisdom of repugnance, where disgust at something like human cloning can be the emotional expression of deep wisdom beyond wisdom's power completely to articulate it. The visceral level, with or without post-hoc rationalization, is all you need in order to know what's right. If it makes you puke, then you must rebuke. The monumental flaw is obvious. Different things disgust different people. Whose gag reflex wins? Moreover, things once viewed as disgusting are viewed differently now. E.g., the idea of slaves having the same rights as whites would probably have struck most white Americans circa 1800 as not just economically unworkable, but disgusting as well. It's disgusting, the things people weren't disgusted by in the past. Disgust is a moving target. Thus, issues anchored in the insula help explain differences in political orientation. This point will be returned to in Chapter 17. Additional neurobiological differences have been demonstrated. Liberalism has been associated with larger amounts of gray matter in the cingulate cortex, with its involvement in empathy, whereas conservatism has been associated with an enlarged amygdala, with, of course, its starring role in threat perception. Moreover, there's more amygdala activation in conservatives than in liberals when viewing a disgusting image or doing a risky task. But not all the findings fit easily. For example, when looking at disgusting images, conservatives also show relatively greater activation of a hodgepodge of other brain regions, the basal ganglia, thalamus, periaqueductal gray, cognitive, DLPFC, middle/superior temporal gyrus, presupplementary motor, fusiform, and inferior frontal gyrus. How all those fit together isn't clear. Naturally, one must ask, have behavior geneticists reported genetic influences on political orientation? Twin studies report heritability of about 50% for political orientation. Genome-wide survey approaches have identified genes whose polymorphic variants were associated with political orientation. Most of the genes had no known functions or were previously thought to be unrelated to the brain. Those whose brain-related functions were known, for example, one coded for a receptor for the neurotransmitter glutamate, don't teach much about political orientation. As an interesting gene-environment interaction, the risk-taking version of the D4 dopamine receptor gene is associated with liberals, but only in people with lots of friends. Moreover, some studies show a genetic association with people's likelihood of voting, independent of political orientation. Interesting. However, the approach comes with all of Chapter 8's caveats. Most findings haven't been replicated, reported effects are small, and these are published in political science journals rather than genetics journals. Finally, to the extent that genes are related to political orientation, links are likely to be via intervening factors, such as the tendency toward anxiety.